Good afternoon. My name is Stephen Barton, and I never expected to be standing in this room introducing the Vice President, in the same way that I never expected to be a victim of gun violence. About a year ago, I was a few hours south of here in Virginia Beach, dipping the rear wheel of a bicycle loaded with camping supplies in the Atlantic Ocean. I was about to embark on a cross-country bicycle trip that I've been planning for several years with my best friend, Ethan. We both had ambitions to live and travel abroad after graduating college, but we realized we had so much yet to learn about our own beloved country. Ethan and I decided the best way to do that would be to spend the summer traveling through Middle America's patchwork, quilt of towns and farms, meeting everyday Americans from all walks of life along the way. And so we dipped our wheels in the Atlantic 1 year ago. 43 days and 2,750 miles later, we arrived in Aurora, Colorado, where we bought tickets to the midnight premiere of the summer blockbuster we've been talking about all trip long, The Dark Knight Rises. I still remember that night vividly. I was hit in the head and torso by a shotgun blast before I'd fully realized what was happening. I fell forward into the aisle and listened to the steady report of an assault rifle as warm blood rushed through my neck, or out of my neck and through my fingers. I remember hearing Ethan, who was not wounded, yelling at a 911 dispatcher through his cell phone. Our host for the night, who sat between us and whose ticket we bought out of gratitude for her hospitality, had been shot in the head. A winding, unpredictable cross-country journey had led us to one of the worst mass shootings in America's history. I thought I was going to die, but I didn't feel ready at all. I was 22 years old. I just graduated from Syracuse University. I had a Fulbright grant to teach English in Russia. If nothing else, I had a cross-country trip to finish. But it wasn't my choice to live that night, any more than it was anyone's choice to die. For reasons I still struggle to understand, the shotgun pellets narrowly missed my brain, arteries, and heart. The gunman's 100-round rifle magazine jammed, giving me time to escape out the back emergency exit and get to an operating room less than 30 minutes later. Ethan escaped without physical injury, and our host miraculously survived without serious damage to her brain. I woke up two doors down from her in the intensive care unit of the hospital a few hours after surgery, filled with more than 20 pieces of lead and a renewed sense of vitality. But my optimism was tempered slightly as I began to place my experience in the greater context of gun violence in America. I was shocked to learn that more than 30 Americans are murdered, and almost 50 Americans commit suicide with a gun every single day, to say nothing of the uncounted sons, daughters, mothers, fathers, friends, neighbors, and wounded survivors left behind. I just spent a month and a half experiencing the best our country has to offer, and suddenly I was being confronted by the worst. Gun violence isn't just an urban issue, as I once believed, nor is it a gang or minority issue. It's an American issue that affects us all. I deferred my plans to travel abroad and began working for Mayors Against Illegal Guns last September. I had the great fortune of meeting Vice President Biden a few months ago in New York City Hall, where he joined Mayor Michael Bloomberg and several families who lost their loved ones in Newtown, Connecticut, to call on Congress to pass legislation reducing gun violence. A minority in the Senate has since blocked that common sense legislation, but the President and the Vice President's commitment to this issue hasn't faded one bit. On behalf of the hundreds of survivors of gun violence I've met during the course of my work, I thank them for their continued leadership on this issue. Today marks an important step forward in our national conversation about reducing gun violence. Ladies and gentlemen, the man who's been helping lead that conversation, the Vice President of the United States of America, Joe Biden.
Folks, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. If you want reason for optimism, you're looking at it. And if you want a great education, go to Syracuse. they're the two mesh. But all you can say, and this is a remarkable young man, absolutely remarkable.
Thank you.
And I look forward to working with you and finishing this job.
Thank you, Vice President.
Good luck to you. Folks, it's good to see so many faces. I had hoped we would have assembled in this auditorium earlier. I had hoped we would have assembled here couple months ago, celebrating the first in a number of victories that we will have, and having the Congress, 44 of our colleagues, or was it 45, voted no on a rational, simple, straightforward extension of an existing background check system that already exists and is constitutionally permissible. But the first thing I want to say before I begin talking about the subject matter, the specific subject matter today, is that we have not given up. Janet Napolitano has not given up. Eric Holder has not given up. Richard Blumenthal has not given up. Congressman Elliot Engel has not given up. Congressman Mike Thompson has not given up. And Speaker Brandon Sharkey of the Connecticut House has not given up. I just wish we had the success you've had up in Connecticut with your governor and with your legislature. And Mayor Pam O'Connor of Santa Monica hasn't given up. Nor has Carolyn Maloney, who is one of the leading advocates for rational gun policy, who is not here today. The congresswoman is not here today because she's fighting another fight. She's fighting a fight that we have her in our prayers. She's fighting lung cancer. She'll beat that, just like she's going to come back and help us beat this gun lobby that has prevented the kind of rational action from happening. 6 months ago, the president and I stood in this very room, joined by the victims of gun violence, parents, teachers, members of law enforcement, and many others, as we made a simple promise to the American people. We said we will do everything that we can, everything in our power, to reduce gun violence in this country. At the time, the shock and horror of the massacre at Sandy Hook was fresh in everyone's mind. Only 4 weeks earlier, the entire country was turning on their television to learn that 20 first graders had been killed in their classroom. Six staff and education personnel had died trying to save them. The entire country sitting at television is a very personal means of communication. You sit there in your living room or your library or your den or your kitchen, and you associate directly with the person on the screen. Everyone who watched what was going on sat there, and I'm confident if they had children, imagined what it would be like if they were getting the phone call. Remember the parking lot, seeing parents run around not knowing whether they go in or out, what was happening, is my child? Every mother and father, every grandparent in the country, you kind of felt it in your bones, wondering, what would you do had that been my baby? Moms called their sons that night, and daughters, not because they lived anywhere close to Newtown, because they just needed to hear their voice. Just needed to hear your child's voice, even your grown child. It was instinctive. Dads tucked their little baby into bed just a little bit tighter and sat there a little bit longer because they wanted to hear the rhythm of their sleep. You know, so I'm here to tell you that the most important message to take from here today is the president and I, our team, we have not given up. Our friends in the House and Senate, they have not given up. We pushed Congress to pass common sense legislation to reduce gun violence. And the majority of the Senate stepped up. The majority of the Senate stepped up and said that makes sense. But because of the invocation of a perverted filibuster rule requiring 60 votes for everything in order to get a vote, we lost. 41 Republicans and 4 Democrats voted no. I am confident some of them, I know for a fact some of them, wonder why now whether that was a prudent vote. And so the president, when he stood here that first day, said he would do everything within his power, constitutional power, to change the ethic about gun violence in America. And it wasn't merely that he said he laid out, we had put together the team I just mentioned. All of us sat together. We interviewed 128 different groups of stakeholders, from gun owners to the NRA to the Brady Group, police officers, et cetera. We came up with a list of the rational things that should be done. But that's not all the president was talking about. On that day 6 months ago, the senator said, the president said, that he is going to do everything in his individual power, under the executive power of the presidency, to take those actions that did not require congressional authority to begin to deal with that problem. And although we have yet to succeed in the House and Senate, but we will, he moved forward on what was within his power, what executive actions he could take. And today I can report that he announced 23 executive actions. 21 of them have been completed, or there's been major progress made toward the total completion, and that we're on track to finish the job. For example, we've strengthened existing background check systems. One of the things everybody found out, except for Eric and I have been doing this our career, is that there's an awful lot of people in states all around America who, under the Constitution, are disqualified from being able to own a weapon, and yet, and their names are held by the states in which they live, and those names have not been communicated to this national system, the National Instant Background Check System. Now, under the Constitution, we are not able to dictate a state take certain actions. So Eric and I and others began to inquire, why in those states, 17 of them, by and large, was this information not getting into the system, already accumulated? Why were those names not in the system? We got all kinds of reasons, one of which was, well, the cost. Well, the president proposed $20 million to incentivize those states, which is easily cover whatever cost they had, to get all of those names, several million of them, into the background check system. Nothing new. The names are already in a file, already in place. And so we're working on that system. We're making sure that law enforcement has the tools at their disposal to combat violence. We're calling on Congress to provide the $10 million, for example. The president's already said that these restrictions on the ability of any federal agency to keep any statistics relating to gun violence and to study the issue, there's an absolute prohibition that existed. President wiped that prohibition off and now says he wants to have $10 million to allow the Center for Disease Control to restart the gun violence prevention research they had in the past been doing. Why are we afraid of information? An informed society should not be afraid of the facts. We're also working to improve access to mental health care. How much did we read and hear about mental health is a component to this problem and part of the solution to the problem of gun violence? There are too many people experience mental health problems who aren't getting the help they need. You know, the most at-risk cadre are people between the ages of 16 and 25 who need the most, not just gun violence, but mental health needs going unmet. So here's what we did. We finalized the so-called Affordable Care Act, I call it Obamacare, so that coverage of mental health and substance abuse services would be available for 62 million Americans for whom they are not available now. A big change. And we made it clear to every state official through direct communications that Medicaid must treat mental health care coverage the same way they treat physical health care coverage. God knows how many moms and dads, knowing they have a child with a serious problem, having no notion about the abuse of a weapon, knowing but not able to afford. Not able to afford to get the mental health care they need, whether they're on Medicaid or whether or not they have their own private health insurance. These are really important actions the president has taken, and time will tell how much positive impact they'll have on this whole issue of gun violence. And there's a number of other executive orders that the president has instituted that are near completion that I won't go into now in the interest of time. But there's one I want to talk about today, and that is the set of guidelines we're releasing today to give schools and communities the tools they need to protect their children. Now, a lot of you are professionals out there. I'll bet you your police department was contacted by about every school district, every school in your district, saying, what do I do if this happened in my school? I personally, members of Congress were getting calls from their district. I personally was getting calls from around the country. Joe, what do we do if anything remotely similar to what happened at Sandy Hook happens in our community? And so the one thing the federal government can really do well, better than any single jurisdiction, is they can scour the nation and find out best practices. They are able to assess and gather all the resources to say what works best. What are the best evacuation plans? What are the best prevention plans? What are the best actions that could and should be taken in the event of a shooter in a school? We provided guidelines in the past, but different agencies sometimes had different messages. So under the leadership of our team, we brought in Homeland Security, which includes FEMA, the single best disaster relief operation in the world, the FBI. We brought in the Justice Department overall. We brought in the, and instead insisted that they sit down together, not separately, together, and make sure they were all on the same page as what were the single best recommendations that could be made. So there's a coherence to this. They all have had significant input in dealing with disasters. And so we put them together in one room with more than 100 experts, from law enforcement to higher education, from K to 12 first teachers to first responders to emergency planners. And we said, all of you come up with what you think are the best practices, the most concrete recommendations that you could give us that will enable us to teach or prepare or lay out a menu for the school districts and churches. The interesting thing is, I think it surprised most people a little bit. Remember Eric and I sitting there, and we had the faith leaders. The faith leaders not only wanted to talk about making school safer, they know, they're worried that their congregations are at risk. So they wanted to know, what should they be thinking about when someone stands up in the middle of a congregation and decides to do something similar to what we saw in the schools? So we gave concrete direction. We are going to, there are three documents that are being made available today. A guide for developing high-quality school emergency operation plans, and that is for K through 12, and a guide for developing high-quality emergency operation plans for institutions of higher learning, and a guide for developing high-quality emergency operation plans for houses of worship. And so toward that end, we took a very, very hard look. And when a school principal gets in touch with the federal government looking for advice, as I said, they shouldn't hear from the Justice Department and then the Department of Education and then the Department of Homeland Security with slightly, we gotta make this bite-sized, we gotta make it understandable, and we gotta make it available, the best thinking in the country. And we made sure the guidance reflects all the lessons we've learned over the years to ensure that schools, higher education, house of worship, have an opportunity to share the latest and best knowledge as an advancement in emergency planning. All that work has been distilled down to the guidebooks I referenced. These books outline a detailed process that every school, every institution, every house of worship should go through to create their own plan within the framework of the best policies available. The guidebooks ask each school or house of worship to consider the fundamental questions that go into the kind of planning and to come up with answers to the questions in close collaboration with local first responders. So the practical impact is we're asking and suggesting, in addition to the specific guidelines we provide, is asking a school district or a school that wants to put in place the best emergency plan to call a meeting. Call a meeting with their local government officials, call a meeting with the police officers, with the first responders, with the fire department, et cetera, and sit down and go through what are the unique aspects of their concern in their school. It details what information can and cannot be shared, for example. There's three pieces of this. One, what can we do through these guidelines to maybe prevent a shooter or a disaster from occurring in the school? One of the things those of you in education know, my wife's an educator, is that there are a number of rules that are out there to protect privacy, the privacy of the student, so it can't be misused. So there's all kinds of federal regulations, actually three big ones. And so school districts and school officials are calling and saying, what am I able to make available? What can be shared about a student or an adult's mental health, past behavioral patterns? What can be shared about their background where I don't violate the law? What am I able to share? Share with the parents, share with the law enforcement officials, and share with those in the school system, so that we may be able to nip in the bud the threatening behavior that we see and is obvious in some students. It also talks about locks and barriers and walls that can be used to protect children. We make sure the planners are asking the right questions. What are you going to do if there's an emergency? How are you going to find out? Who needs to know? What's your plan for alerting teachers and students? Where should they go? How will you make sure the students with disabilities can be taken care of? If there's a fire, do you have an evacuation route? If the route is blocked, what's the alternative route? If, God forbid, there's an active shooter, how are you going to alert the people? Do teachers know what they should do? These books will tell you what to do, and they start with the conversation that schools and communities should already be having with their first responders, parents, and teachers. And we're going back, and we're going to back it up with training. The Department of Homeland Security has conducted briefings on over 100 school districts thus far. In addition to that, the FBI worked with some of the top experts in the field at Texas State University to update Justice Department tactical training for officers that respond to active shooter situations. The FBI held a two-day workshop on active shooter situations at every single one of the 56 field offices nationwide, which reached senior command staff from more than 1,850 state, local, tribal, and campus police agencies working with communities that represent millions of people. This is a huge mobilization of the resources to make sure that our front lines and law enforcement know absolutely what the best protocols for responding to these situations are. And it's going to help save lives, not only potential victims in harm's way, but cops as well. So as I've said, we've made significant progress here. Taken together, each of these actions I've outlined today would reduce gun violence in America. But let me make a very important point before I close. As proud as the president is, as proud as I am of the progress we've made, we need Congress to act. The American people are demanding it. As I've said before, we need to make sure the voices of those we lost are the loudest ones we hear in this fight. We need to make sure that everyone in the country knows that this fight isn't over. Far from it. And I would yield to my friends in the House and Senate But I assure you, the one thing that each of us have been saying to our colleagues about these votes is the country has changed. You will pay a price, a political price, for not getting engaged and dealing with gun safety. It used to be, before Sandy Hook, that the polling data would show that although 60, 70, 80% of the people supported these significant and sound proposals we made, that when it came down to it, the 30% or 20% that didn't support them, they'd show up on election day. They would make that the single most important issue. And the other 80% would say that was a nice vote, but it wasn't a determinative. What changed in Sandy Hook? What changed with Sandy Hook, the straw that broke the camel's back, is now those people who support rational safety measures say, this will be a defining issue for me. For the first time, a clear majority of those who favor rational proposals say, it will matter. It will make a difference in who I vote for. That's a fundamental change in the political calculus out there. And I will not mention names, but look at those who voted no, and look at what their poll results are in their states immediately after voting no. Many who were popular and were in the 50s and 60s now find their favorable ratings in the 40s. And many of those in very tough states made very tough votes based on conventional wisdom, like Kay Hagan in North Carolina, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, and others. Their poll numbers have gone up. Because the country's changed. The country's changed. And nothing we're asking for, nothing we continue to pursue, is inconsistent with the constitutional rights every American has. Not a single solitary thing. So, folks, I am optimistic. I know people say I'm always optimistic, but I am optimistic. I'm optimistic because I've gotten those phone calls from those members of Congress, many of whom voted no, saying, can you find a way? Can you find a way? Can you find a way for us to revisit this? And so that's exactly what we're going to be doing, counting on the leadership of the members of Congress that are here, and I mean that sincerely, and counting on the continued leadership of the workhorses in this administration, at Homeland Security, Department of Education, the Attorney General, because the American people are there. But in the meantime, the president is going to continue to take every executive action within his power to make schools safer for our children, churches safe places to worship, and significantly work on reducing the number of gun deaths in America. Ladies and gentlemen, since Newtown, more people have died at the end of the gun than we have lost in Afghanistan. Pretty astounding. Pretty astounding. And Iraq, as a matter of fact, over 5,000. There's no way to run a country. The public knows it. They know we can do something about it. And no matter how long it takes, we're determined to do something about it. Let me close by thanking my colleagues in the administration and my friends in the Congress for not giving up on this. We got a majority, but not the supermajority needed. We will get it. We will be back. And we will, in fact, improve the lives and safety of all the children in America who should look at school as the safest place in the world they can be. Thank you very much.